offering our humble pranams at Bhagavan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam. It's a series in which we've studied the 1990 summer course series, and as I say studied, it is because we've completed playing out all the discourse clips in that series. But as we promised, we are here with a summary of the last 8 discourses. We took a break after the first 8 discourses and had a brief summary of the first 8. And so at the end of the 16th discourse, we are venturing into a summary of the second half of discourses which were delivered there. Before we begin, I invite my brother Sai Prakash to join me on this program. Sai Ram, Sai Prakash.
Sai Ram Prem. It's going to be a real difficult task.
Right, we have to do all the talking.
Yeah, there is no Swami to help us today.
Right, in that sense of playing out discourses of Swamis.
That's right, and it's like an examination. Now, let's see what you have grasped.
Right, very true. And it's a different feeling going through these discourses in that sense of trying to get an overall look of what Swami said.
Correct.
And seeing a kind of connectivity between one and the other. You know, there was an advantage of playing short clips.
Correct.
Because we get to go into the details which Swami goes into. You know, even when Swami narrates a chinna katha, there is that overbearing theme which is of course there. But apart from that, there will be so many other nitty-gritties and little lessons which Swami would intertwine in that. So when you play short clips, you always have that advantage of going into those details, and we always had the pleasure of recollecting incidents from Swami's life and devotees' lives.
Correct.
In relation to those points.
Very true. But on the other hand, now looking at the whole discourse as one piece.
Right.
I mean, as you were just mentioning before we went on air, that Swami has very beautifully answered so many questions that might come up in our minds.
Right.
And most of Swami's vahinis are written in that tone, where Swami, it's like a conversation. In fact, that's the reason why I think it's in one of the Satya Sai Speaks, where in one of the discourses where Swami mentions, this is not upadesham, this is sambhashanam.
Okay.
He refers to his discourses as sambhashanam. Sambhashanam is a conversation.
Conversation, right.
So he says it's a conversation with my devotees. And many times we have heard Swami mentioning that he is actually standing there on the podium and answering the questions of many of the devotees seated there. And it's like that X-ray scanner. Swami would just, you know, very lovingly look at all the people just before he started his discourse. And then Ganga would just flow.
Right. And, I mean, another thing which we've, you know, as I was going through these discourses, another thing which, recollection which came, or should I say a deja vu, you know. When you sit in a class,
yes,
there's always a logical flow in the concepts and themes and the ideas which is being taught.
Yeah.
But if you lose your attention somewhere in between, you know, you tend to miss that connectivity. And you say, okay, something was said before and now something is being said, so this also must make sense, though I'm not able to see it. You know, many times in Swami's discourses you see that. You don't see the connectivity because I think somewhere midway we lose our attention. But
that's
when
true.
You go over these discourses again and again, you see that there is a beautiful flow of thoughts, and Swami is wonderfully connecting something which is absolutely profound with something which is absolutely practical.
Correct.
Which you can just take away and say that, you know, all that is fine, but what do I start from tomorrow?
Correct.
So that, there are those
right.
action points which are given in the end.
And specially tailor-made to Kali Yuga.
Right, absolutely.
I mean, I think it's coming in this chapter of Buddhi. But what comes to my mind is how he compares it to the aeroplane. I mean, he says it's like the aeroplane taking off and landing
right.
down.
Right.
He says the one who is on a spiritual path, it's like the aeroplane taking off, where the two wings are satyam and ritam, and they have to be balanced. I mean, Krishna could not have given an example of an aeroplane, but it's all tailor-made for Kali Yuga.
Right.
So I think before we go to the 9th chapter, we have to very briefly look at what Swami told in the 8th chapter, because that's where the topic of Buddhi starts.
Right.
And he says, this classic example of the chariot and the comparison with
the horses
and the senses. So here Swami says, the charioteer is the Buddhi. So just to recount, the chariot is the body, the senses are the horses, the rein is the mind, and the Buddhi is the charioteer. And
the one who is traveling in the chariot
is the Atman.
Is the Dehi.
Is the Dehi. That's right. So he says, Buddhi is the charioteer. And in the eighth discourse, Swami gives various definitions of Buddhi. Buddhi gyaha grahya matindriyam. He says it's beyond the senses. And then he goes on to say that it is also called antarvani. But what I really wanted to draw attention to in that chapter was about the bird of Buddhi. So right. He says in the Taittiriya Upanishad, Buddhi is described as a bird in which Shraddha or faith is the head of the bird. The right wing is Ritam, the left wing is Satyam, and the main body is Mahattattvam, the tail is Yoga. So he says these are the various aspects of Buddhi. So it's very interesting because it's so significant that the bird cannot fly without proper balance. And Satyam and Ritam, just to expand on that, he says if you have unity of word and action, that can be considered as Satyam. Like there are empirical truths and there are events in life. So you see and you report, you are not lying about it. This is how it is, that is what it is. That is Satyam. But Ritam, he says, is absolute Trikarna Shuddhi. You have to have unity of thought, word and deed.
Right.
And more or less, I think that is possible only when you are on the spiritual path. Because the ultimate truth is you are. And to have a Trikarna Shuddhi means to always live in that awareness. So he says Satyam and Rutam are the two wings, and the Mahat Tattvam is the main body of the Buddhi, and Shraddha, or that is faith, right? He says faith is the head of the bird.
There's an example which just comes to my mind, which I think Swami told one devotee.
Okay.
How do you obey Swami's commands? You know, it is like, suppose you're going to somebody and asking, I'm looking for this particular building. Okay, where will I find it? Even in the ashram, somebody comes and says, you know, where is the north block or where is the south block? We tend to tell them in a very general manner, you know, you just have to go straight down this road.
Correct.
Just keep going straight and you'll meet that building in the end of the road. So Swami said that if somebody gives you a direction like that, that is the general direction.
Okay.
So you know where to go. When you're going there, let us say that you are meeting with a wall.
Okay.
It just means that you have to take a little detour and go around the wall.
Correct.
But if you say that, no, that person has told me to go straight, and you just keep going straight and bang into the wall. So Swami said that both things are important. One is you get the overall picture of where you're going, what is your destination, and you also use your common sense to realize, you know, at that moment, should I turn left, should I turn right? Suppose a car is coming in front of you, you stop and you give way for the car. You know, in that moment, you're moving away from the final direction which is given to you. Instead of going straight, you're stepping left, or you're stepping back, or you're stopping.
Correct.
So Swami is saying both are important, that at that moment, what you're supposed to do, and having that overall vision of where you're going.
Correct. That's true. In fact, put in a slightly different way, so in conversation with Dr. John Hislop, he asks, now that I know all this, what should I do? Swami says, actually they were on their way to Anantapur in Swami's car.
Right.
And Swami says, now what is going on? He says, Swami, we are in the car. So where are we headed to? Anantapur. So have you reached Anantapur? He says, no, Swami, I have not reached. But you know you are going to reach. Yes. Why? Because you are on the right path. So you have to be sure you are on the right path, and then just be like nishkama karma. Just be and do your actions without expectations. When you are on the right path, you will reach your goal. So simple. Swami explained it in the car journey.
Right. In fact, in another example which somebody was giving, very beautiful. You know, suppose you have a house which has been unoccupied for a long time.
Okay,
it's been unoccupied for a few years, and understandably, it starts collecting cobwebs and it's in a mess. And till the point where we are talking of that house being unoccupied, you don't know how long that house is going to be like that. So in that sense, it's hopeless. You know, the house is going to remain like that all the time. Let us say that the owner of the house has managed to sell it.
Okay.
Okay, the deal is signed. Okay, the moment the deal is signed, even after that, the house still has cobwebs.
Right.
But immediately you know that it's just a matter of time before that house comes to a living condition.
Correct.
That person was saying that that is what makes the difference when you, the day you decide to turn spiritual.
Okay, okay.
Life does not change overnight. But immediately there is that hope of sometime down the line it's all going to be
right
where you're going to.
Right. I mean, it's like the final realization may happen in an instant.
Right.
Like in the same analogy, Swami also says, you need, just because a room is in the dark for 20 years, you need not take 20 years to light it up. All you have to do is the flick of a switch.
Right.
But to come to that level, I suppose there is a lot of
right
back work that has to be done.
But that is where Swami talks about buddhi as being very important.
Yes.
Because that buddhi has the ability to help you in that current situation.
Correct.
To do what is right then at that point.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, it gives you that ability to stick your vision on that which is the ultimate.
Correct. It's very interesting when Swami gives statistics and, you know, percentages. He says, buddhi is 90% atma.
Right.
So that was something very interesting. He says it's 90% atma. So when buddhi is turned towards the atma and takes instructions only from the atma, then you're on the right path.
Right.
And just to, you know, expand a little more on this bird of buddhi, Shraddha, he says, you have to have, Shraddha is different from Medha Shakti. He says, Medhas or intelligence is different from Shraddha.
Right.
And he says there are two aspects.
Mm-hmm.
One is that is Astha and Swastha. That, or it is Ashakti and Stiratva. Stiratva is the firmness. And Ashakti is the zeal and the faith.
Right.
So these are aspects of Shraddha. And he says that forms the head of the bird. See, here when Swami is talking about faith and zeal, on another occasion Swami often says, Utsaham, Sahasam, Dheryam, Buddhi, Shakti, Parakramam. These are the six qualities for anyone to be successful. And the first one is Utsaham. Enthusiasm. Here also in the bird of buddhi, you have to have that freshness, you have to have that enthusiasm. Yes. And that spontaneity, which Swami exemplified all the time. So that is Shraddha. Then you have the two wings, that is Satyam and Ritam. The body is Mahatattvam. He says Mahatattvam is nothing but I am that. Tattvamasi.
Yes.
Tattvamasi is the Mahatattvam. And the tail is Yoga. So, yoga is something very, very interesting. And here, Swami defines yoga in a very beautiful way. He says, yoga here means the control of the mind and senses.
Right.
He says that gives balance to the entire body.
Because Swami says that, you know, in a sense that yoga which gives that real balance and, you know, direction to that bird is non-attachment.
Okay.
And that can be achieved only when there is control over the mind and the senses.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you know, in the later, in fact, the discourse which follows has more of buddhi than the topic which is mentioned in the chapter. Because there Swami says that only when you are non-attached to the result of what you are, the discrimination which you're going to do, your discrimination will be perfect.
Mm.
And that is why Swami says that yoga there is, you know, control of the mind and the senses. You are not being drawn by the mind and the senses. You are able to make the right decision based on what is there in front of you.
Correct. And then Swami goes on to say that buddhi is considered as the resound reflection and reaction of the atma. On the other hand, Medha Shakti, the power of worldly knowledge, corresponds to Maya Shakti, the divine power of delusion.
Mm.
So he says there's a very clear distinction between Medha Shakti and buddhi.
Yes.
And it's very, very interesting because we give so much importance to worldly knowledge and then proficiency and efficiency and how much you know, I know more than you and all that. But in the ultimate analysis, he says, does it matter? So, I think that was more or less what I wanted to bring attention to in that chapter. But then I think quickly we can go on to the next discourse.
Yes.
That is called egoism and attachment.
Right. And in that sense I was telling you, a lot of that buddhi is brought in here.
Mm-hmm.
And in a very subtle and beautiful way.
Correct.
As we go through it, we'll realize that.
Yes.
Of course, Swami starts by talking of, you know, man being a seeker of bliss.
Correct. eternal seeker of bliss.
Right. Mm. Beautifully he says that, you know, the idea of living life and the idea of going through life, whatever you do in life is in search of that bliss.
Correct.
And Swami says the body, senses, mind, intellect, all these are given to experience that bliss.
Correct. He says, your nature is bliss.
Yes.
Man's very nature is bliss, and you are not going to ask somebody, why are you happy? Why are you smiling? If somebody is crying, you are going to go and ask him, why are you crying? Because by nature, you are meant to be happy. You are meant to be blissful.
No, this is a very beautiful point which Ami is making. You know, just some time back, I was listening to a debate between an atheist and a theist. You know, heard of Richard Dawkins.
Okay.
He's supposed to be a very famous atheist,
yes,
in that sense.
Yes.
A biologist by profession.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there he was talking about science and why he stands by science.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying that, see, science stands for truth.
Okay.
Because, I mean, I don't know if God is there or not, but what I want the younger generation to carry forward is that desire to have the truth, desire to search for the truth.
Okay.
And in a sense, if you see, why are the scientists going after truth?
Mm-hmm.
It is for a sense of satisfaction.
Correct.
You want to feel that I am going after the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
But in that sense, the person who was talking on behalf of religion, he was saying that, see, what are you doing this for?
Mm-hmm.
Religion focuses on that.
He says,
what are you searching truth for?
Mm-hmm.
Religion focuses on that.
Mm-hmm.
And it is not wrong. What you're doing as a scientist is not wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just that religion has taken a step backward, and it is going into something which is more deeper than what science is looking at. And that's what Swami says here.
Mm-hmm.
If you understand that everything is for bliss,
and
if you realize that the body, senses, mind and intellect is given for bliss, automatically you will use these for that purpose, and that will give you the direction.
If I just remove the lens called 1990 Summer Course Discourse and look at this episode through that lens, I would say that science is basically with the senses and through the senses, but spirituality starts beyond the senses and beyond the mind.
Right.
Because science believes only in what can be seen, what can be felt, and what can be experienced. So it is very much within the limits of the senses. And the day they accept that there is something beyond the senses, I think that's when it seamlessly merges into Vedanta. And in fact, quantum physics is leading to that.
Right.
So here he says, it's almost like your nature to be happy, if it's like how sweetness is to sugar. That's its nature, that's its dharma. And that's what defines sugar. So it's your nature to be happy. But you can be happy only when you get rid of body attachment. So he says, the body is tainted with raga and dvesha, and the senses are shrouded in desires and sensuous pleasures. He says, everything that is given to you is, you know, being tainted by something or the other. Like the body is tainted with raga and dvesha, the senses are shrouded in desires, the mind is polluted by impurities, and as a result, man is not able to recognize his true nature. So he says, you get rid of all this, then you are automatically happy. Happiness is what you are.
And again, you know, this is again quite a philosophical part where Swami is saying that the mind is tainted by this, then, you know, immediately what in the later part of this discourse Swami says, you can relate all this, all these problems to the problems of the food.
Yeah.
The impurity in the
correct,
food which
correct.
You intake.
Correct.
That's how Swami starts. Swami, of course, talks a little about buddhi, and he's saying that the weakness of the buddhi is, in a sense, the reason for man getting deluded. But then Swami is saying that all these problems are arising because of wrong food.
Correct.
And then Swami talks about the importance of doing Brahmarpanam, the importance of purifying food by offering it to God.
Correct.
And then, interestingly, you know, Swami speaks about this wonderful episode of Shankara beating Mandana Mishra.
Yes. And Uma Bharati.
Right, Ubhay Bharati as the, you know, the judge for that debate.
Correct.
You know, this is a very beautiful thing. The entire discourse which Swami gave on Buddhi, Swami kind of summarizes in this one episode.
Correct.
Because Swami explains that Ubhaya Bharati actually stood for Buddhi.
Correct.
This discourse, Swami saying she represents Buddhi, and the same things which Swami told about that bird, you know, Satyam, Vritam and Yoga, Swami says those are all the qualities of her.
Correct.
And that is why Shankara agreed that even though she was the wife of Mandana Mishra, she could be, because she was such a balanced person. Swami is, you know, the qualities which Swami refers to here, beautiful. You know, he says that she had that steadfastness, she had that balance, she had that firmness, and she had that non-attachment.
Correct.
Because of which she had the ability to give the right decision.
Correct.
And if you look at the other way, you know, Swami, historically, Mandana Mishra represented that school of belief which was called Purva Mimamsa.
Correct.
Or that which goes into the deciphering of dharma and karma. And Adi Shankara stood for Advaita Vedanta, which is like everything is ultimate. There's nothing, the duality is non-existent.
Correct.
That kind of thing. And if you look at it, here is a debate between that which believes that you are the body and talking of karma and dharma as the ultimate. And here is the other school of thought which thinks that everything is one.
Correct.
And Swami is saying that when there is a debate between karma and Vedanta, if the buddhi is equipped enough to give you the difference between the two, it will declare that Vedanta is the winner.
That Advaita is winner. Right. It's towards the Atman.
Right. And beautifully Swami has put that you do what it takes to make this buddhi as independent and as pure as it can be. And when this debate between, you know, what is duality and non-duality comes, it will have the ability to rightly decide that yes, non-duality is what is the truth.
Correct. Then there is that beautiful story he proceeds to say, after this debate between them, Mandana Mishra becomes Shankaracharya's devotee, a disciple, and then Ubhaya Bharati has her own ashram. And then he tells that beautiful story of how there is a monk. Again, this story is also equally important because he says, what is the reason? He says, Ahankara and Mamakara. So, Ubhaya Bharati is walking for her morning ablutions with all her disciples, and there is this monk lying on the side with a jug. He says, Swami says, it's
I think the begging bowl which he uses or something.
It's just a jug on which he is putting his head and is lying there. And then she says, just to give him the right perspective, she says, look at him, he has given up everything, but he's attached to his jug. And this sets this man thinking, and he says, she is a lady, and how can she tell me this? I am a renunciant after all. And then when she is coming back after her bath, he goes and breaks the jug in front of her, and she says, I thought he was only attached. Now I know he is even...
he's having even ahankaram.
Ahankaram, ego. So then he falls at her feet. And this story again brings out the two main reasons why we are stuck in this.
Right. So beautifully Swami says, no, the root cause for bondage. He says, see, that is what it is, ahankaram and mamakaram.
And buddhi is the one that has to set it right.
Buddhi is the one who is telling, you know, that this is the mistake that you are having. This is the mistake that you have to handle. And then, of course, Swami goes on to again talk about, you know, food being the reason for this kind of wrong beliefs and the problems of the buddhi. And Swami tells the story of Bhishma trying to give
advice to
the Pandavas when he's lying on the bed of arrows. And Draupadi laughs at him, saying that, you know, you were a witness to the most heinous of crimes against me, and now you are discoursing on dharma to my husbands who have always stood by dharma. And then Bhishma, of course, says that now that I have bled all the food which I have eaten from the evil Kauravas, now I am left with my pure beliefs in what is right and what is wrong. And that is what I am advising.
But, you know, here there is a very beautiful point. He says, those who are attached by this attack, or those who are with this ahankara and mamakara, he says, they will forget what to talk with whom, when, where and how. He will forget what to talk with whom, when, where. Samayam, sandarbham, Swami always says. He says that, yes, you may be talking the truth, you may be telling what's important, but there is a time for everything. There is a place for everything. There is a way of telling. It's so delicate. I mean, only thing that comes to my mind right now is when you're trying to enter the gate and the Sevadal does not, Sairam, 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 you know, that same Sairam can be told in a different tone.
Right.
Like, when you say Sairam, it's like, okay, you're telling with respect. So, it's the tone, it's the place, it's the person. So, when, where, whom, what to talk, he says, a person with ahamkara and mamakara will be misled.
In fact, you know, we're just talking to one of our old students who is into healing and some kind of therapy and all that.
Okay.
So he gave a beautiful, you know, insight into how these therapists deal with their patients.
Okay.
You know, he said, see, most often, most of us can, in a sense, kind of sense what is wrong with the person who's coming to them.
Mm-hmm.
He said, it's everybody has it. It's not just, you know, it's not some special skill which anybody has.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody comes to you with a wrong intention, invariably you can kind of sense it.
Sense it. Okay.
Somebody comes with you with a problem, you can sense it that, you know, this is the problem. It's depression, or he's kind of, he's suffering from low self-respect.
Mm-hmm.
It can be sensed. But a therapist will know how to handle it.
Correct.
It is because, you know, he will know that, okay, at this point, he needs to be given confidence.
Mm.
So you can praise him now. You, otherwise, you think that at this point, he has to be pulled out of this. He needs a little bit of strong words.
Mm.
So he says a therapist can put aside his personality and deal with the problem.
So is he the modern Buddha?
he said, yeah, that's what he said, you know.
Mm.
Sometimes that the patient who comes could get a little abusive in their words.
Correct.
They can be very angry.
Mm.
But you have to put yourself down and, you know, control your anger, control your ego, and say that, no, I am dealing with the problem this person is having.
Not with the person.
Not with the person. And he said that is what helps you. Because in a sense, that's what Swami said, you know, all of us can sense what the other person is having, but we react.
Correct, correct.
Swami would say, don't react, and you can be without reacting only if you have control over your, you know, ego and your feeling of what is the other person thinking of you and all that.
Correct. And of course, when he talks about Draupadi, and as he goes on, he says, every human being has within him or her five husbands in the form of five life breaths.
Right.
Prana, apana, vyana, udana, samana. And whenever Swami spoke about Draupadi, he is, you know, spoke of her as Pativrata, and is always all praise for Draupadi. And it's very interesting, because if you look at Mahabharata, and as I mentioned earlier, Swami said that Mahabharata is Panchama Veda because nobody is born naturally, nobody died naturally. And what a unique, I mean, it's a strange setup where one wife having five husbands. I mean, even in modern days, it doesn't happen. Means, I think the Mahabharata is such that it is stretched to the extremes. Everything has been stretched to the extremes to show that even in such a situation, you have a way out if you follow Dharma. I think that's what it stands for. Otherwise, so again, Swami harps back on Ahamkara and Mamakara, and he says that is the main reason. And as you rightly said, the food.
Right. In fact, that is when Swami beautifully explains towards the end, I think towards the very end of the discourse, Swami says, food is what is taken in.
Correct.
Through all the senses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not. And then Swami says this, you know, mind is always pure.
Correct.
But when you're taking in the food, which is brought by the senses, and if you do it indiscriminately, the mind gets impure.
Correct.
And Swami says that is why you have to use the filter called the buddhi.
Mm.
Take in what is right and, you know, leave out what is wrong. And then Swami beautifully says that, you know, you have the senses, mind, buddhi and atma. The man who follows the senses becomes an animal. The man who follows the mind will remain a man. The man who follows his buddhi will become a great man, Swami says. But the man who follows the atma will become one with Brahman.
Beautiful.
And, you know, in a sense, giving that gradation, I think all of us follow our senses and the mind to an extent. So Swami is saying you're just in the level of a mind, a man who has conquered his animal nature.
It's very interesting because buddhi, as you think of it, has a large part of, I think, what we would call as intuition.
Right.
Like, I think even in science and scientists, most of the amazing discoveries and inventions happen in that flash. And I think that flash is because they are able to stay thoughtless at that time. You know, when they have just steadied their mind, when their mind is absolutely thoughtless, in that instant the buddhi reflects the atmic principle. And that is the flash. I mean, I'm just trying to understand if that's the way it happens. But I think that's what it is, because many scientists, see, with all the years and hard work, and every time you think, you are using your mind and your senses. But when you stop thinking and when that flash comes, that is buddhi. Isn't that right?
I think it should be that way. Even if you look at many of the serendipitous inventions, you know, one might think that it has come from gathering of the knowledge. Because most often that's what they say. You know, these scientists have trained their mind. They've been seeing, they've been observing results and observing experiments. So at one point they are keen enough to pick up even in a, what is otherwise would have been seen as an aberration, and then they come out with an invention. But it could also be that when they've stopped that observing, when they've stopped that gathering, maybe that insight is coming from within.
It just reveals itself.
Right.
It just reveals itself.
A classic case of that is maybe that of Kekulé.
Correct.
You know, who came up with the structure of benzene.
Benzene, yeah.
You know, he was breaking his head and he was not able to draw the structure of benzene.
Yeah.
Just in one night, he gets a dream where he sees a snake biting its own tail. That's
correct.
The story.
Correct.
And immediately he wakes up and says, oh God, it's a cyclic structure. Aromatic compounds are cyclic in their nature. You know, it's like that. When, I mean, how can you say that this is coming from the mind?
Yeah.
When it comes in a dream state.
Correct.
It could only mean that all that knowledge which you're seeking is within. And maybe at some point when you're able to still the mind, you will be able to, as you said, the buddhi might reflect the atma.
Very true. In fact, in this context, it won't be out of place to mention that Swami had told one of his few of his students at that time that the best way to listen to my discourse is to start listening to the discourse and then go to sleep. Yeah, because there was one of the
doing it.
No, there was one of the school teachers who took these boys with their ears, caught them by the ears, and took them to Swami. Swami, they were sleeping during your discourse. Swami says, so what? And they say, Swami, your discourse, when you were speaking, they were sleeping. And then he says, so what? He says, but that's how, that's the best way of listening to my discourse. He says, because as you start listening to my voice, and then you, you know, naturally fall asleep, it goes directly to your subconscious. And this is something amazing.
I think we've mentioned this right in the beginning of this program once. You know, when you say Shravanam, Mananam, there's a Dhyasanam. Swami had said, Shravanam and then Mananam. Don't do Mananam when you're doing Shravanam.
Correct, correct.
He said, when you're listening, as much as possible, don't try to process it.
Yeah.
That's what we always do, you know, even as, especially when you're in a conversation. As you said, Swami's discourses are the Sambhashan. You know, in a conversation, we tend to do that. Even as you're telling me, my mind is working, what should I reply? You know, what incident I can tell which is in sync with what you are saying. But Swami says that when you're listening, just listen. And then go back and recapitulate. And, you know, do the mananam. I think that itself will take a few years. You know, that's a practice which might take a long time for us to learn.
The next chapter is named The Three Gunas. And I feel as if it is like pulling out one, you know, hidden textbook from the secrets of creation. You know, he just pulls out one textbook from there and then he says, now take, understand this. It's like basically the pure secret of creation. The, you know, how everything came about from the five elements. So I think we can quickly summarize this chapter by just saying what it is. He says, everything in this creation is has come out from the five elements.
You know, initially Swami starts with that poem which says, you know, not the poem, where he talks about Sarvam Kalvidam Brahma. That's what he comes to in the end. Saying that everything that is God.
Is God.
Now Swami is telling that, okay, if everything is God, why do you see the diversity? How has the diversity come about?
Correct.
And
correct.
Then Swami says that, you know, all varied experiences arise from the three gunas.
Three gunas.
There, bang, the introduction starts. But then what follows is nothing what we expected, I think.
So, I think very quickly we can summarize this by saying that the each of these five elements is influenced by these gunas. Like the five elements of Shabda, Sparsha, Rupa, Ras. No. The five elements of fire, space, air, fire, water and earth.
Yeah. Interestingly, you know, Swami, even when he's talking about the five elements, he says there are two sets of five elements.
Yeah.
He says five subtle elements
and
five gross elements.
Very true.
So when Swami starts with the first set of elements which Swami is telling is the five subtle elements.
Correct.
Swami says those five subtle elements, when they go through the process of the three gunas, eventually, that's much later, will give you the five gross elements.
Correct. So first, in the sattvic aspect, he says that due to the sattvic nature of these five elements, we have the Jnanendriyas. The Jnanendriyas are formed by the sattvic manifestation of these five elements.
Yes, in the sense Swami says that sattvic aspect of akasha is the air.
Yes.
The sattvic aspect of air is skin.
Yes.
The sattvic aspect of fire is the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
That of water is tongue, and that of earth is the faculty of smell.
Yes. So the nose represents the sattvic aspect of the fifth element.
Right. And then Swami says that since each of these qualities has come from one element, that is why they cannot do anything else.
Correct.
They do only that. They can, you know, the ear can only hear, the eye can only see.
Correct.
The tongue can only taste.
Mm.
Swami says because they have all come from different elements, each one can do only one thing. And that's the beauty when Swami goes to the next set of...
the rajasic manifestation.
Right, the rajasic manifestation. Swami says these have come from the combination of the five elements.
Mm-hmm.
And then Swami, you know, he says that, well,
no,
yeah,
the
antakarnas combine all functions.
Correct.
You know, the manas, buddhi, chitta and ahankara. Swami says they use the inputs from all these elements, I mean all these organs.
Mm.
So Swami says they manifest from a combination of these five subtle elements.
Okay.
Not from each one coming from one element.
Okay. And then there is also prana.
Yes, that is the rajasic aspect.
Of the manifestation of...
So just, we'll just do this one more time, maybe a little slowly. Swami says that each element, when in its individual state, goes to the sattvic aspect, gives each one of the five senses.
That is the pancha jnanendriyas.
Right.
Yes.
Now when these five subtle elements combine together, and then when they are subjected to the sattvic quality, what you get is the antakarna.
Okay.
And when these combine together is subjected to the rajasic quality, what you get is the prana.
Prana, correct.
Yes.
And then that expresses, again, the rajasic quality expresses as the kanmendriyas.
Right. Now the rajasic qualities as individual elements now.
Yes.
So akasha alone, if you see, it comes out as voice.
Yes.
Vayu comes out as hand. Agni as feet. Water and earth as the excretory organs.
Correct.
And again, you know, here again Swami beautifully says that why is this rajasic and why is those jnanendriyas as...
Correct, sattvic.
Sattvic, because Swami says the jnanendriyas are used to intake material. So that which takes in is sattvic and that which expresses out. So Swami says that, you know, you hear, how do you respond? You talk.
Correct.
So hearing is the sattvic aspect, talking is the rajasic aspect. So similarly Swami says, you know, that for air is skin. You are being touched is the intake of stimuli.
Yes.
How do you react? You react with your hand.
Hand.
Swami says an ant is running over your body. You push the ant out.
Correct.
So Swami says that each one is, you know, in that manner, complementary to each other.
Correct. And then comes the bombshell. Yes, we have been able to summarize the sattvic and the rajasic. And then comes the more complicated...
The panchikritam.
Yeah.
The process called the panchikritam. Swami says how these five subtle elements form the five gross elements.
Correct. You are a chemistry student. It's almost like mixing two, three liquids together.
In fact, you know, there is a wonderful game. I think many people are familiar with Android smartphones will know. There's a game called Alchemy.
Okay.
Okay. In fact, that is in a sense based on this very concept.
Oh.
Where you have the five elements and you try different combinations and they say that you put these together, you get this. Then you combine with some of the base elements and then you get something. Then so it's almost like that, you know. Swami says that five subtle elements give the five gross elements. He says that, and the way Swami explains was beautiful. There are five people, each one having a rupee.
Correct.
And then they exchange it for change and they make it into a...
16 annas, right?
Right. Swami says
one-eighth.
One is a 50 paise coin. The remaining 50 paise coin is encashed into 8 annas.
Correct.
And then Swami says that you take 150 paise coin and then one anna from each of the other elements.
Correct. So basically it is each element, 50% of that, the nature of that element remains.
Right.
And the rest of the 50% is made up of...
1/8 of the other four elements.
1/8 of the other four elements. So this is the tamasic manifestation of these five elements.
Right.
Jai Hind.
No, the wonderful thing is, you know, Swami is saying, in the beginning of the discourse, Swami says, see, everything is from God. Okay, and these combinations and all these, and Swami has just come to the five gross elements. And Swami says, everything else that you see is a combination of these five gross elements.
Correct.
So which means we are just at the beginning of that, you know, from one to many, we have only come to one to five. So that five to many is the rest of creation. So Swami says that science spends all its time in understanding that aspect of creation. But Swami is saying that here everything is God. Are you stopping and trying to analyze and trying to reach the Creator?
Correct.
So he's saying that if you want to get lost in this creation, there is enough time, enough scope for it, because this is how complex it is. But are you ready to turn back in and look at the Creator?
I mean, he has not left any gap. One eighth, if you conquer one element also, it's not enough.
Right. And again, you know, this was the beautiful thing is, you know, till now Swami was just kind of leaving us flabbergasted with all this information and mind-boggling information. But towards the end, Swami is saying that, all right, now we have understood that it's not enough if we understand the creation. We have to understand the Creator and the secrets of the creation. And you can understand the secrets of creation if you understand the Creator.
Correct.
Swami is saying what to do for that. You know, Swami gives three practical points. Beautifully brought down, Swami says, performance of one's duty with earnestness and sincerity. That is the first one.
Correct.
And the second thing Swami is saying, rendering service to people.
Yes.
And the third one is developing love for God.
Correct.
You know, this is what I meant, you know, suppose you're sitting in a lecture, you forget or you miss a few points in between, you really don't know how the connection was made, but you just say, thus proved. But, you know, Swami is beautifully saying that you may or may not understand whatever was said. Because in understanding, these all come under the Samkhya school of philosophy, where they say how creation came about. But Swami is saying that you may or may not understand all this, but if you do these three things, you try to inculcate these three things, then you're good to go. You're going at the right direction.
Correct. And then that beautiful story, he says, worldly desires. He says, man is drawn by worldly desires, and that's what binds him to the world, actually.
Right.
You desire things for your body, you desire things for your senses, for your mind. And that beautiful story is of Goddess Lakshmi.
Right.
And there is this devotee who gets the grace of Goddess Lakshmi, and she asks, what do you want? He says, I want you. You please come to me. She says, okay. In fact, Swami also would do that. He says, Swami, I want you. He said, take me. I'm here. Take me. So that's what Goddess Lakshmi said. Yeah, I'm coming. But only one condition. Kani, that pause which Swami gives. So she says, only one condition. Do not look back. I will follow you and come. Till you reach your home, don't look back. Just go ahead. So as he was walking and he would hear the anklets on the Devi's feet, he would hear the sound, and smiling to himself he was walking. Suddenly the sound stopped. And then he could not control himself and he turned back and saw. And Goddess Lakshmi just vanished. So he says, you are not able to control your desire even till you reach your home. Like, so he says, how can you expect to have God's grace? In fact, in this Gita Vahini, Swami says very beautifully, he says, you may have God's grace in abundance, but unless you have control, you will not make the best of it. God's grace is always there. Swami's grace is always there. It's always there. It's your readiness that counts.
In a sense, what Swami is telling in the story is, you know, it's easy to understand that God's grace is there when it is obvious. You know, we were all in Swami's presence. When Swami would come and talk, when you have a problem, Swami comes and addresses it. It's very easy to see that Swami's grace is there. But the ability to perceive that grace, even when it is not obviously shown, that is what was important. You know, I'm reminded of a very beautiful advertisement which used to come, you know.
Okay.
It is about some particular product. the way they show the advertisement is there is a baby which is swinging on a cradle.
Okay.
Okay. And it's very beautifully made. I don't know how they've made it.
Mm.
When the child comes near the camera, the child is smiling.
Okay.
When the child goes away, the child is crying.
Okay.
Okay. And it's going on and on. It smiles, it cries. It smiles, it cries. And then they show the camera from the view of the baby. Okay. The baby is, its cradle is right in front of a window. And every time it swings towards the window, it can see the symbol of that product which is being advertised. And when it goes away, it's not able to see the product. So in a sense, I think this is how we are all behaving with Swami, you know.
Correct.
When we can see the grace flowing, we are happy and we are joyous. But the moment it is out of sight, just out of sight, it's not that it's not there. Just when it's out of sight, we are in doubt. Is Swami really taking care of us? Is it, I mean, are we still under His protection?
So that's why, in fact, after that He comes to the same point. He says, whatever sadhana you may do or you may not do, develop love for God.
Right.
And He says, yes, it's like knowing the secrets of creation, knowing all this definitely helps you. But with pure love for God and, you know, focused love only for God, automatically these things will get added on.
Right. In fact, Swami then goes on to tell the story of Vibhishana and Hanuman.
Hanuman, right.
How beautifully Swami puts it. Because He talks about that episode where Hanuman tells Vibhishana it's not enough. If you just chant His name, you have to do His work.
Correct.
Because even the 3 points which you read out, Swami says that develop love for God, but go and serve people.
Yes.
Swami said, that is the essence, you know. I am telling you that you start with God and then you have the five senses and the five three gunas and the various combinations. The idea is everything is God.
Yes.
So if you love God, in action it has to express itself as service. You
very
go out
true.
And serve people.
Mm.
And then that's what Vibhishana is told to by Hanuman. He says that you are loving God, you are chanting God's name. But when an opportunity to serve Him is right in front of you, why aren't you seizing it?
Correct.
Why aren't you doing God's work? And then of course that other interaction between Vibhishana and Hanuman, where Swami says Vibhishana tells Hanuman that I am like the tongue which is in the midst of the 32 teeth, because they are all people who are you know, haters of Rama around here, and I am like the tongue in between teeth. And then Hanuman says beautifully, you know, he says that don't worry, just persevere with your sadhana, because in time all the teeth will fall away, but the tongue will not.
Correct. Means he says when you are looking at the creation and you get lost, you become a slave of your senses. He says that beautiful rhyme there. First the man drinks the wine, second the wine drinks the wine, and third the wine drinks the man. So it's like you get drawn into it. That's all. And, you know, connecting it back to what really gives you happiness, I think he says, go to the creator, not the creation.
Right.
That's, I think, more or less what Swami brought out in that chapter.
Yes, the 10th chapter in Three Gunas.
And now we are just stepping up. We are going to something subtler than the subtlest. But there was one point which Swami made, which was interesting. He said, ahankara is subtler than the buddhi.
Right.
He says, yes, buddhi is there. Buddhi is 90% atma. Buddhi is there. But ahankara is subtler than buddhi. See, the identification of the body, whatever, you know, buddhi you have, whatever you may know it. See, theoretically I may know that I am the atma, I am not the body. But that ahankara, that attachment to body, it stands in between buddhi and atma. He said it's subtler than the buddhi. So finally, I think the 11th chapter he comes to know thyself.
And of course, it's a needless to say a very, very profound discourse. And it's a discourse which kind of shakes you from your beliefs and kind of it gives you a very, very fresh perspective.
Correct. But it's also very, very moving to see how Swami has gradually brought us to this. It's not something that just that's been told.
Right.
It's been brought gradually to this, and it's the same secret which Nachiketa stood for 3 days to know what happens after death. I mean, when he's asking what happens after death, that is when Yamadharma Raja gives him the knowledge of the Atman. So he had to stand for 3 days without food and drink, while, you know, we can sit and
talk about the samukas where people were being fed and overfed and then being given this knowledge.
That's right. I mean, it's so amazing. And also, yes, I mean, think of technology also as a boon. We are able to hear Swami's voice again, and we are possibly, if we are really true seekers and we had contemplated on Bhagwan, he would have given it directly to us as well. But now we are using technology too.
And we also can take it in our, at our own pace.
That's true.
What was given in a span of 15 days,
yeah,
we've got to take it in more than 15 months.
That's true. And still I feel we have not done anything close to justice.
Right.
Well, I think these two chapters, which both of them deal with the Atman.
Right.
I don't know if you have the time to do that now.
I think we'll just begin with what this discourse says.
Okay.
I think eventually the next discourse will have to wait for next week.
Okay, sure.
In essence, you know, Swami goes back to saying that, you know, it starts basically with what is the Atma.
Mm-hmm.
And Swami says Ahankaram is when you associate this Aham with the body. Aham,
yes,
plus Akaram is Ahankaram.
Correct.
But Swami says that the awareness is nothing but Atma.
Mm.
The feeling of that, you know, existence,
mm-hmm,
that which is, Swami says, that is Atma.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives responsible to consciousness or the feeling of I.
Mm.
And this I, when it is associated with the body, results in Ahankara. So it's almost like, as you said, Ahankara is subtler than the buddhi because it's just one step away. It's that thing which separates you from that awareness completely. Mm. And that's why maybe it's the most subtlest. And then Swami says that this feeling of I consciousness, when you remove the mind from this feeling of I consciousness,
yes,
that is what is Atma. So in a sense, though Swami is saying Aham plus body is Ahankara, you know, body by itself is inert. That which binds this Aham to the Akaram is that mind.
Correct.
Is that
correct.
Mind which makes you believe that this is what you are.
Mm.
So Swami says the day when you're able to remove that mind, you are the I. I think when Swami says mind here, it is not the manas, it is the antakarna itself.
Correct, correct.
Because I think in that discourse about the antakarna, Swami says the ultimate step or the ultimate journey is the sublimation of the antakarnas.
Correct.
Not
so,
the purification, but the sublimation.
So just to recount, the antakarnas are mano, buddhi, chitta, ahankara. Manas is the mind as we know of it. Buddhi is
intellect.
Mano, buddhi, chitta. Chitta is bank of memories.
Memories
and ahankara is body attachment.
Right.
Yeah.
And then Swami talks about the paradox in sadhana. Or
yeah,
you know, spiritual practice. He says the idea is to give up the mind.
Correct.
The idea is to weaken the mind and kill it.
Mm.
But, you know, first of all, to understand what you are, you're doing sadhana, which is absurd. You know, what is already with you, to discover that you're doing something which is external.
Correct.
And then Swami says that that which is, the idea is to kill this mind, but all sadhana only strengthens the mind.
That's the thing.
Because Swami is saying that you feel that I have conquered, I have achieved this, I have controlled my mind, you know, I have done so much. So Swami is saying in the process you're only strengthening this mind and strengthening that feeling of ahankaram.
Identification
with that body which is doing all these things.
He says it looks as ridiculous as a thief putting on a policeman's dress in an effort to catch the culprit, that is himself. Can't be put more beautifully.
Right.
And in a sense, the mind is the thief because it steals you away from the truth.
Right.
And what is this mind? And in the chapter on mind, how beautifully Swami, that kalpa vikalpatpakam manaha, that thing, that's one of those definitions where it's a bundle of thoughts. And then Swami says these are like waves. And any agitation, that's what gives shape and existence to the mind.
Right.
And what are these thoughts? These thoughts could be based on memory. These thoughts could be based on events that you're seeing. So anything that vibrates, that shakes, that gives rise to the mind.
Right.
And he says it's like a cloth with lot of thread interwoven. Each thought is like a thread. If you just remove each thread, then there is no cloth.
In fact, you know, Swami gives a beautiful combination of, or the relation between various things, where he says, as long as the mind is there, the desires will be there.
Correct.
As long as the desires are there, the feeling of mine and thine will be there.
Yes.
As long as the feeling of mine and thine are there, the ahankara or false identification will be there. And as long as the ahankara is there,
ajnana is there. Till you remove this ajnana, you won't get atma ajnana.
There's no point. And you know, interestingly, Swami is talking about sadhana and talking about various things, meditation or bhajans or something like that. There was one discourse which I went through sometime back. I think it was delivered in 1988.
Okay.
Swami had called some of these overseas devotees who were at the ashram that day. Swami said, I just want to give a discourse to all the overseas devotees.
Okay.
So they were all filed into the bhajan hall and Swami gave a discourse for them.
Okay.
There, the entire discourse, it's a very beautiful discourse. It's about the five D's.
Okay.
Discipline, devotion, and the various things which Swami says. So Swami starts defining one by one. What is devotion? What is discipline and all that? So when it comes to what is devotion, Swami says, what is devotion? Swami asks, is doing bhajans devotion?
Okay.
Is doing seva devotion? Is doing meditation devotion? Swami says, no. Swami gives a beautiful explanation. Swami says, only devotion is nothing but gratitude to God.
Okay.
And then Swami says, this gratitude expresses itself as doing bhajans, doing seva, doing meditation, doing japa. And you know, when you put it in that perspective,
correct.
See, here Swami is saying that all these activities are strengthening your mind because you're doing it with a motive to achieve something. The moment you say that these are all going to be expressions of gratitude, you know, when you say gratitude, you're not going to expect something in return for gratitude, right? You know, gratitude itself is something which you give in return for something you've received. So when you say that these are all expressions of gratitude, you will automatically do it without expecting anything in return.
Very true. That's what in the 12th chapter in Bhagavad Gita, where many of the shlokas end with Bhaktiman, ye sacha me priyaha. He is the one who is dear to me.
Dear to me.
He is a devotee who is dear to me. Swami gives a very subtle point. He says, we are always thinking of what we are doing. Hare, I am praying to Swami, I am doing this, I am doing that. He says, you should always think of what God has done for you. That is gratitude. He says,
right.
That is gratitude. That is exactly what it is. He says, that is devotion. Devotion is actually thinking of what all He has done. Just contemplate on that. That itself
exactly.
is...
Because Swami says that gratitude is devotion. There is nothing more than that.
Correct.
But in a sense, we think, you know, we are devoted to God. We are loving God. You know, somewhere, that's the difference. You know, suppose you say, Swami has pure love for everybody. The image which comes to your mind is, Swami is always giving.
Correct.
Right? But when we say, in the worldly level, you know, I love somebody, we are talking of being the receiver. When you look at Swami and say, Swami, I love you, you are talking of being the receiver. You know, that is a disparity which is there in the way we see Swami's love and our love. But Swami, as you said, you know, in the Bhagavad Gita, He says that you have to perceive yourself as, you know, the one who has received, and the love which you're having is the action of you giving. It is not giving to receive, but giving for what you've received.
Correct, correct. See, He says, all sadhana that you do is for stilling the mind. He says, but why do you want to still the mind? You are not the mind. Go beyond the mind.
And Swami also makes that point that all sadhana that you do is nothing but for mental satisfaction.
Correct.
It's not going to get you anywhere. It's only going to give you mental satisfaction.
I think we should play this back to Swami and say, Swami, this is what you told. But it's like, you know, I think we have quoted this example off and on. But it's like the structure of the atom. Like, you have to go through the phases, you have to go through the different stages of learning. Yes, Niels Bohr's structure of the atom has to be gone through before you go to quantum physics and to study the actual structure of probability and all that. So, that is MSc and PhD syllabus. This is school syllabus.
And in a sense, you know, you're getting 10% in your fifth grade does not mean that there is no sixth grade.
Yeah, that's right.
Even if you're the best one at the fifth grade, you are going to have something which is above that. That is what Swami is doing here. You know, each discourse is taking you to a level which is higher, and each time Swami is as uncompromising as he was in the previous discourse. So I think should we stop here, because the rest of this discourse I think will be overlapping with what Swami told in the next discourse.
Yes, I think that's why I was thinking we should take it up as a pair.
Right.
And both these discourses are about the Atman.
Right.
And ironically or paradoxically, we are trying to speak about that which cannot be spoken of. I mean, it can only be known by knowing what it is not. You can only know what you are not.
Right. In fact, that is what Swami tells in this discourse.
Mm.
He says the only way the mind can be put to rest or could be killed is if you understand the nature of the mind. If you make attempts to see what is this mind doing, how is this mind binding me, that is the only way it is going to, you know, as it is said that when you start observing an entity, it starts misbehaving.
That's right.
It stops behaving it's the way it was behaving till then. Swami says that's the only way. You have to keep looking at the nature of the mind.
I mean, that's why it is said that kaschit dhiraha. It's not everybody who can take up to this path. Because you need to be 100% convinced, and you should know this is the path I am going to take, and you should be very clear this is what is of essence and of importance to me. Nothing can trouble me. I am.
Anyway, so I think we'll conclude with that, Sapikash. I think we are in the 11th discourse.
Yes.
Midway. We will continue with that remaining part of that discourse and the 12th discourse.
Mm-hmm.
It's similar in theme, and hopefully we'll complete the other discourses in that series, or we'll just take it as it comes.
Yes.
So that, dear listeners, was a brief summary of some of the discourses which we went through in the later half of the Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam programs we've been having. As we told you that we've completed playing out all the discourse clips, we are in the process of going back and summarizing some of those discourses. We'll continue this next week too. So please do join us as you've joined us today. We offer this humble effort of ours at Swami's Lotus Feet. And thank you all for joining us. In a short while, we'll be joined by Bishu with the last segment of the day, Outside, Inside, Deep Inside. Thank you. Jai Sairam.